Welcome into Words with Wallace. I'm your host, Nick Wallace. Coming at you, it is Thursday, June 2nd, and we have the NBA Finals matchup set. Oklahoma City Thunder versus the Indiana Pacers. Can't pretend that this was the finals I was hoping for or the finals I was expecting, but I'm excited for it, and I really am. I think we got two deserving teams, all things considered. We'll have to talk about exactly what to expect in this NBA Finals matchup. So, in this podcast, it's obviously been a little over a week since the last time I talked to you guys, so we're going to discuss the ending of both the Eastern Conference and the Western Conference Finals. Really wanted to dive into where the Knicks and the Timberwolves go from here. I feel like there's been a lot of buzz about the teams that were eliminated from this postseason and what their future looks like with the new salary cap, maintaining current players, the offseason decisions that they have to make. So wanted to take a spotlight for the Timberwolves and the Knicks specifically, and then we're going to cover Indiana's road to the finals, how they got here, same thing with Oklahoma City, and then at the end of the podcast, we will go through my NBA Finals prediction, right? Not going to give a ton of analysis just about the series straight up, because we will have some time to get out some podcasts, probably after like Game 2 or Game 3, something like that, but plenty to cover in this episode, so let's dive into it. Let's get things started by talking about the Oklahoma City Thunder and their dominant win over the Minnesota Timberwolves in 5 games. And so this series was a bummer. I was hoping that Minnesota was going to come out on top. Really, they were the only one of the 4 teams left that I really liked and had any sort of rooting interest, having worked for the Timberwolves many years ago. But unfortunately, that was not an enjoyable series for the Wolves. The only game that they actually went up there and won was a really fun night for the Wolves, I'm sure. They went out and beat the crap out of Oklahoma City in their first game at home. I was at a wedding that night, so didn't even get the opportunity to watch the Wolves blow them out. But really, every game besides that game, which was Game 3, OKC just looked like they were in a different class than the Timberwolves. It was just that simple. Really, everything that Minnesota could do, Oklahoma City could do at a higher level. Minnesota had a great defensive team. OKC was levels above that, right? Anthony Edwards, great player, incredible scorer, so many different ways he can beat you. Well, Shea is just a little bit more polished, has a little bit more experience, and was definitely the better player in that series. And the only game that we got that was really remotely close, I think the final score ended up looking a lot closer than what the game actually was Game 4. And that one ended up being the dagger of the series, right? That's really the game that I wanted to highlight out of the 5 there, because they're coming off the big win. Emotions are riding high. It's kind of a gut check moment for the Thunder, right? How do you respond after Minnesota shows a ton of life at home and just beats the brakes off you in Game 3? So it's a huge opportunity for the Thunder to rebound, and they definitely did. And Minnesota's role players came to play in Game 4, right? Jaden McDaniels was unbelievable. Nikhil Alexander-Walker probably had the best game of his entire career, especially when you obviously include the stakes of what that one meant to the team. Dante DiVincenzo, he was awesome. But the problem for the Wolves is that neither Anthony Edwards or Julius Randle had it going in that game. They shot a combined 6 of 20 from the field with 10 turnovers. And I think what stands out there, besides obviously the turnovers, that's just the Thunder's superpower, right? They get all of these teams to turn it over at a much higher level than what we're accustomed to. But 6 for 20 is definitely not good when you combine, again, Julius Randle and Anthony Edwards, they're shooting from the floor. But I think the more striking thing about it is just how low 20 shots is, right? On a night where Anthony Edwards or Julius Randle has it going, they are very likely to shoot 20 shots individually. So with that in mind, it just shows you that the Thunder were so disruptive on the defensive end of the court. Anthony Edwards just was not being aggressive enough. Same thing for Julius Randle. I think he was 1 of 7, so he just kind of stopped shooting altogether. Randle finished with 5 points, and so I think that says more about Oklahoma City's defense than it does, you know, Julius Randle or Anthony Edwards just playing terrible, because it felt like the Wolves were doing enough to win the game with the boost that they were getting from their role players. But on the other side of the ball, I think this was the most impressive game that we've seen from Oklahoma City, maybe all postseason, right? Obviously, Game 7 at Denver comes to mind for them to just like set the tone and win. You know, obviously that was a must-win game. Their entire season was on the line, but all things considered, I've never seen the big three of Oklahoma City all play better in a single game like that. I mean, Shea was unbelievable. I think he had 40 points in that game. J-Dub had maybe his best game in the playoffs. He chipped in 34, and I think Chet had 20-something himself. But it was really the defense for Chet that stood out. Like, he had a couple, like, jaw-dropping blocks and just defensive plays that you really, maybe only Wemby is the only other guy in the league that can make plays like that. And that was really the first time where I was like, Oh my God. Like, I started to come to terms with how scary this could be for the rest of the league when you look at the Thunder. Because, you know, I've obviously always believed that the Thunder were good. They certainly are not here by fluke, but I had them losing in the second round to Denver for a reason, right? I just felt like they might be a year away. I still haven't seen that many instances where all three of their top players are truly playing like superstars. Like, I could see how Chet would get there one day. I could see how J-Dub would get there one day. But they just haven't put it together on a consistent enough basis for me to really buy in. Now, the counter argument for that is, like, they really didn't even need those guys to be stars to amass, you know, 68 wins in the regular season and cruise with the first round and all that stuff. Like, their superpower all year long is their youth, is their depth, is what they can do on the defensive end of the court. So they're not counting on these guys, you know, J-Dub and Chet specifically, to be stars every night. But when they are, and they play that well as a big three, it really is terrifying, because it's almost like a hybrid of, like, what we saw with, like, the dynasties from the 2010, how, you know, you look at, like, the Heat team that won a couple titles in a row with their big three, and the Celtics had a big three, the Spurs had a big three, all that stuff, right? But we really don't see modern teams being built like that anymore. We've just found that depth is more important. With the new CBA, it's nearly impossible to get three guys making max contracts on the same team. I think it actually is impossible. But all that to say, like, it was a major throwback to OKC having an old school big three, all those guys coming into play, able to overcome just a truly remarkable game from Minnesota's role players in game four. And then ultimately in game five, I mean, that game was over like a few minutes in. Like, Minnesota had 9 points at the end of the first quarter. You could tell just by the body language of the people on the Timberwolves, I think they were ready to call it a season. So it was disappointing to see them go out like that, but there weren't really many big takeaways or storylines that I got from that series against the Thunder, right? I figured Minnesota might have the opportunity to steal an extra game if Ant was really able to go crazy and have like that 40 plus point night, which we never saw from him in that series. But, you know, besides the Wolves maybe not being as close as we quite thought, I don't really think there were any other takeaways. And we are going to talk about where the Wolves go from here in a little bit. So that does it for OKC versus the Wolves. I'm sorry I didn't spend a ton of time on that series, but it just felt like my recording schedule didn't really align with that being a quick series to begin with. But don't worry, we will talk much more about the Thunder moving forward in this podcast. Kicking things over to the East, let's recap what took place in the Eastern Conference Finals. Of course, the Indiana Pacers were able to defeat the New York Knicks in 6 games. I do still feel like we were probably robbed of a 7-game series. You know, maybe that comes down to just how insane game one was and the fact that the Pacers really had no business at all to win that game. So maybe if the Knicks are able to hold on and win that one, we do get a 7-game series. Maybe the Knicks are the ones heading to the NBA Finals right now, but I guess we'll never know. Just to kind of recap this series, I did obviously watch all of these games live, but, you know, it's been some time. We got a lot of stuff going on. So I just wanted to, like, kind of peruse the box scores and, like, basically summarize each of the 6 games in, like, you know, a few words or less. You know, game one, that's obviously summed up by the insane Nesmith heat check, the crazy shot that Halliburton hit, and really just one of the best comebacks we've ever seen by the Indiana Pacers. In game two, the Pacers were able to steal that one as well, in large part because that was the Pascal Siakam game. He just had everything going. He was really being able to create his own shot at a high level, which is not something the Pacers ask him to do often. I think he finished with 39 points in that game. Game three was incredible in its own right. This is what I'm calling the Karl Anthony Towns game. He finished the fourth quarter with 20 points, which helped fuel a major Knicks comeback. I think the biggest lead of the game for the Pacers was 20 points, even though that was in the first half. They started the fourth quarter only up by 10 points, so the Knicks had already done some damage in the third. But if it wasn't for Karl Anthony Towns just cooking in the fourth quarter, some outside shots were falling, and really, it was just his ability to get to the rack above anything else that the Pacers had no answer for, and that gave the Knicks a much-needed first win of the series. Moving on to Game 4, this is one that the Pacers were able to win. This was definitely the Tyrese Halliburton masterclass. I mean, he was unbelievable in this game. He had, like, 32 points, I want to say 15 assists, and 10-plus rebounds. I mean, it was a loud 30-point triple-double. He hit every big shot, and he also made a lot of plays in the defensive end of the court, and so the media buzz for Halliburton at that point after that game was just nuts. Then he followed that up in game five with like an 8-point outing. And this was just like the ultimate, the Knicks wanted it more, right? They were able to win this game pretty comfortably. It was really the only boring game that we had the entire series. You could just kind of tell that the Pacers had already mailed it in game five, knowing they were going back to Indy with an opportunity to close it out in game six. And even if all else failed, they would fall back on a game seven if they really had to. But it didn't get that far in game six. This is what I'd like to call the Andrew Nembhard game. He was so good in this game with 6 steals. Finally, after a terrible outing in games 2 through 5, Nembhard rebounded on the offensive end of the court. I think he shot above 50% in the game. And it definitely helps when you get role players like Thomas Bryant, who were completely unplayable early in the series. He had to step in because there was a Tony Bradley injury of all things. So he's thrust back in the rotation for game 6, and he chipped in 11 points in only a couple of minutes. So, but that kind of summarizes the series. I think the better team ended up winning the series, even though I picked the Knicks in 7. I mean, I felt like it could go either way, and the Pacers were definitely more deserving. You know, you get game 1 in dramatic fashion like that, and you're able to really take a commanding lead in the series by winning both games in the Garden, following that up with the game 2 Pascal Siakam game. So it did feel like the Knicks found something at some point when they made the decision to start Mitchell Robinson over Josh Hart, and then all of a sudden Tibbs is playing guys like Landry Shamet and DeLon Wright and suddenly giving them like a real unit to turn to off the bench, because you already layer in the fact that, you know, Robinson had given them good minutes off the bench earlier in the series. Now you have Josh Hart in that spot. Deuce McBride was pretty consistent contributor for them. And, you know, Precious was good for some higher energy minutes every once in a while. But ultimately, they couldn't hang with the Pacers' pace, ironically enough, right? Really, the only games the Knicks won in the entire series were the ones where they forced the Pacers to play at a slower pace than what they wanted to, and they really just forced the Pacers to play the Knicks' style, and they were only able to do that in 2 games, of course, one of those being Game 3 in the second half, and then the other game being Game 5, but beyond that, you know, we really watched a really impressive performance by the Indiana Pacers team. We're watching Haliburton turn into a legit star. He's not at that last level of consistency that you need to see from the truly top players in the NBA, but there's no question he is the engine of this team, and really they take on his identity, right? Like the fact, like this selfless nature where everybody's passing the ball up, where, you know, even after a made basket, the amount of times that we saw the Indiana Pacers end up with like a one-on-one transition opportunity or sometimes even a wide open layup off of a make is unbelievable. And this is a Knicks team that is obviously accustomed to playing the Pacers, you know, basically every other night for the past week. The fact that they couldn't figure it out and eventually adjust to what the Pacers were trying to do and the tempo that they were trying to play with just shows how annoying the Pacers style is, how hard it is to stop. And Haliburton is the biggest reason why. You need your best player to buy in, set the tone, set the style in which you're going to play. And whether we like Haliburton or not, which I tend to not, I at least have to respect that he is a one-of-one player in the NBA, right? He's truly a rare breed when it comes to like that older school type of point guards. Obviously, he still has the ability to shoot the three ball at a high level and create his own shot, but he's a pass-first guy who is the best player on his team, which is really rare in the modern NBA. And it's a huge credit to the roster that the Pacers have been able to build around that guy and the coaching staff, what they're able to get out of this group. It's really impressive. Also, we should probably mention the Eastern Conference Finals MVP, of course, that being Pascal Siakam. That was pretty surprising. I can't believe I'm in a situation where I have to defend Tyrese Haliburton, but this decision to give Pascal the award really just blew me away. And I know it's kind of a stupid award. I don't really understand the reason that the NBA even started recognizing the conference finals MVPs, but since they are, I'm going to have a take on it. And I feel like Tyrese Haliburton had to win this award. I get how if you just, you know, parachute into this series and you look at the final box score, you see that Pascal Siakam averaged 25 points per game. That was 4 more points per game, better than Tyrese Haliburton. He also was really efficient shooting the ball. I think he was like 50% from 3 in the series against the Knicks, and he also shot a better percentage from the field overall compared to Tyrese Haliburton. But I just think for a playoff series and everything that this series meant, you can't just kind of look at the box score and especially the overall series numbers and just be like, okay, that guy had better stats, he deserves to win. It is worth noting, and I think anybody that's watched the Pacers can see, that Haliburton is the engine of the team. He also led the team in assists and averaged more rebounds than what Pascal Siakam did in this series. And he had the memorable games, right? I mean, Pascal Siakam had game 2, but I think that was really the only game in which Pascal outplayed Haliburton and the Pacers were able to win that game. Because if you go through it game by game, I would say that Tyrese Haliburton easily had a better game 1. He also hit that legendary shot to send that game into overtime. Then you have the Pascal game in game 2. So that's 1-1 for those keeping track. Game 3, that's one where the Knicks won, but I think Tyrese was comfortably a bit better in that one. So that's another game for Tyrese. Game 4, that was the Tyrese Haliburton, probably the best game of his career in which he had the 30-point triple-double. Now we're looking at 3-1 in favor of Tyrese playing better. Game 5, that was definitely a Siakam game, albeit the Knicks ended up winning that one pretty convincingly, and neither of those guys were super impressive, but we'll give the nod to Pascal there. Then you get to game six. I guess that one's kind of a coin flip. If I had to give the game ball to anyone for the Indiana Pacers, it would be Andrew Nembhard. So I don't even know where that kind of slots in. You could probably say Pascal and call it even there if you really wanted to, just because he ended up finishing the game with 30 plus points. But you could still make the argument that what Halliburton did overall was more impactful. But ultimately, when it is a tie in a situation like that, or maybe a slight edge to Halliburton, but then you factor in the moments, the fact that in the Halliburton games, the Pacers had a better record overall, and he has the most memorable shot going all the way back to game one. And we already know that Tyrese Halliburton is definitely the most valuable player on the team to begin with, and he is really the reason for the entire Indiana Pacers style. He should have won the award. I'm sorry. It is what it is. I hope it doesn't end up being one of those things that hangs over Halliburton, albeit no one really cares about these conference finals MVPs. But I just don't want it to hang over a guy like it does for Jason Tatum, like it did for Steph Curry for a period of time, because it's just, it's not deserved. And that's what happens when you give out stupid awards. But I don't know how you arrive on Pascal Siakam for that type of award. Just wanted to chime in and say that. I was never that impressed with Pascal Siakam as an offensive player, really, because, you know, he's not that talented as an individual scorer. It's pretty rare for him to just like go off like he did in game two and just consistently create his own shot, consistently generate his own offense. Like, that's not his MO. But suddenly you get this like really athletic 6'9 guy in transition where like Josh Hart is the only guy back to stop him. He's going to score like 95% of the time in those situations. And the amount of transition looks that he gets because he is playing in this Indiana Pacers system, he's also arguably their most important defender. Like, he was awesome in this series. I just wanted to tip my cap to him. And again, I just wanted to show credit to the guy I love more than any other Indiana Pacer. It's got to be Andrew Nembhard. I know my guy Connor is probably listening. He's been in the Nembhard hive since high school, which he reminded me of the other day, which is kind of funny. But he was the main reason that the Pacers won comfortably in game six, right? The six steals that he had, the energy that he brought, being able to suddenly have like a lot of confidence guarding Jalen Brunson. There was one point in the game where Brunson actually like headbutted Nembhard in the face when the Pacers were making a big run and the refs missed it, but they picked it up on the broadcast. It just kind of showed you where Brunson's head was at. I think he only finished that game with like 18 points or something. It was really the only bad Brunson game that we got in this series. And it was just a huge credit to Nembhard, who mentally took him out of the game, physically took him out of the game as well. And it was just a really impressive performance from him that they were finally able to stop a guy who was basically unstoppable the entire postseason. Like, we saw guys like Drew Holiday, Derek White really fail to do any sort of resistance against Jalen Brunson. And the fact that Nembhard was the guy in that situation, along with Nesmith during other points in the series, was a really strong close to the series for the Indiana Pacers. Before we continue our talk on the Indiana Pacers, Oklahoma City Thunder, and what that finals matchup is going to look like, I just wanted to spend a couple minutes discussing where the Knicks and the Timberwolves go from here, right? Despite the fact that, by all accounts, both teams had a really successful season, exceeding the expectations of even their own fans by getting to the conference finals, they're not immune from offseason decisions that they're going to have to make. There's a whole lot of buzz with the Knicks, especially right now. So I wanted to spend a couple minutes breaking that down. Let's start with the Wolves and where they go from here. Really, they're going to go as far as Anthony Edwards is able to take them, right? I don't want him having a subpar series against a historically great defense distract everyone from the fact that he's in really rarefied territory with what he was able to do the past two seasons and the past two postseasons specifically. Like, I don't want to be like a Wolves expert here because I'm not, but I can tell you just in my brief time, like working for the team, like, that is a franchise with no expectations. That is a franchise that has won next to nothing in their entire history, right? I think they had one conference finals run with KG, and then they had like a 14-plus year playoff drought, something like that. And you go from all that to being back in the mix with back-to-back Western Conference finals appearances when they weren't even the betting favorite to get out of round one the past 2 years. Like, that's not nothing. And I know that we kind of look back on this Wolves run with like a sour taste in our mouths, A, because they got pantsed in against the Thunder, we understand that, but also it's like, oh, well, they got lucky with that injury to Steph Curry, like maybe they wouldn't have beat the Warriors. I agree, you know, I picked Golden State in that series, but you can't control who you play against, and the fact that they were able to just immediately take care of business, dispose of the Warriors in four straight games after Steph got hurt. And we got to go all the way back to the Lakers series, right? Like, nobody, literally nobody that I know, besides maybe a couple Wolves fans out there, picked the Timberwolves to win in round one. Like, no, I know on paper and with hindsight, it's like, oh yeah, well, the Lakers were a flawed team and, you know, they didn't match up athletically and they had to play the same five guys. Like, yeah, all that's obvious now, but it wasn't obvious when real people, real NBA media personalities weren't just taking the Lakers to come out of that first round series. They were taking the Lakers to go like all the way to the NBA Finals. So the fact that the Wolves easily disposed of that team in five games when nobody was taking them seriously, after they did the same thing to the Suns last year, then they go out, they beat Denver in a really dramatic Game 7, a comeback win on the road for Anthony Edwards last year. And yes, they lose to the Mavericks, but I just want to highlight that back-to-back conference finals appearances for a team whose best player is 22 and now 23 years old is ridiculous, and it just doesn't happen all that much. And so whatever your concerns are with the Timberwolves, I think that this was, like, by all accounts, like a transition year. You got to think back to the offseason where they traded a guy in Karl-Anthony Towns who, before Ant got to town, like, Cat was legitimately the face of the franchise. He was a number one overall pick. He was a guy who, I think one year, the NBA GMs all voted that if they could have any player to pick one guy to start their franchise with, one year, Karl-Anthony Towns actually won the answer to that general manager's poll. I think that was in like 2017, 2018, something like that, which is stupid. He never should have gotten that much hype. But look, this was a former face of the franchise that they traded away just a few weeks before the start of the season. And they get back like Julius Randle. I mean, I'm sure there's some Knicks fans out there that still love the guy because he had like some really awesome years there. He made like at least one All-NBA team. And you get back Dante DiVincenzo as well. Like, those were not pieces that any Wolves fan that I talked to were excited about, right? And the fact that they take this mismatch group, they obviously had their ups and downs in the regular season, but they end up being a top six seed in a loaded conference, and you make it all the way to the conference finals. Like, again, I'm not here to give everybody a participation trophy every time they lose a playoff series, but what the Wolves did here was special. And there are real decisions to be made, right? Of course, namely with Julius Randle and Naz Reid. I think those are the two headliners because Julius Randle, he has a player option that he can pick up for next season. And I want to say it's the same situation for Naz Reid. I think Naz Reid's is for like $13 million or something way lower than what he would command on the open market. So you can basically guarantee that Naz Reid is going to decline that option. I think there's still a chance that Randle opts in for that, you know, $30-plus million option that he has for next year. However, he played so well in the postseason. Now, granted, his production fell off a cliff a little bit with OKC, but I think he had, like, in three of the five games he was solid, and two of the losses he was really terrible against the Thunder. But all things considered, he really exceeded expectations of what anybody had for Julius Randle in the postseason. He also finished the regular season strong, so maybe he worked up his market value where the Timberwolves could consider paying him, like, 30 to 40 million or more over the span of the next couple of years. Or maybe there's a different team out there that once he declines that option wants to pay him in free agency. That I don't know. So maybe they sign one of those guys and just, you know, kind of stake their flag in Naz because he's younger and he's homegrown and whatever. Maybe they stake their flag in Randle because he's a little bit more talented right now. Maybe they do both and completely lock themselves into this core for the next 5 years if they're able to make the numbers work on that. That I'm not sure, but those are really the main questions. But the important thing is that I don't think this team is going to look radically different. Anthony Edwards is still going to continue to develop. He's going to be even better next year than what he was this year. And look, while I wouldn't put the Wolves in like that top tier of contenders when I do that first tier list at some point next season, I still think that they're in an awesome spot, probably a better spot than maybe 25 other teams off the top of my head right now, because they have a top 10 player in the NBA who has a chance to be even higher, who's only 23 right now, who's checked all the boxes of being a two-way star. I still think the Wolves are in a really great spot, and I don't think they necessarily have to make any crazy roster changes right about now. Moving on, I think the Knicks are a little bit more interested to figure out where they go from here, but if you ask me, and I'm suddenly the one in charge of the Knicks, I would say that they're running this back. That would be my advice to the New York Knicks right about now. There's a ton of buzz out there about the Knicks moving on from Kat, about the Knicks moving on from their coach, Tom Thibodeau, or maybe even Bridges. And frankly, after the season they just had, I don't understand really any of that buzz. Maybe with Tibbs, we'll talk about in a second. But let's start with Kat. I can't believe I'm in this situation right now where recent events in the NBA have forced me to be a defender of like Tyrese Haliburton and Karl-Anthony Towns, players I just had no interest in whatsoever before this season, during the season, even right now. But I gotta call a spade, and I feel like Kat is getting a lot of hate right now that he doesn't deserve, right? He was clearly a flawed player before the team even traded for him last October. I think anybody that watched any crumb of Minnesota Timberwolves basketball knew that there was a reason this guy was available, although the trade was still really surprising. And of course, like the dumb fouls and the concerns on defense, like that didn't go away. But I think if anything, he played better than expected during this playoff run. It was kind of interesting that the outside shot, what he's really known for, being one of the best stretch bigs in the NBA, maybe the best stretch big in the NBA, You know, I think he only ended up shooting like 5 threes a game against the Pacers, which was more than what he shot against Boston, and he ended up making a couple more. But he didn't really constantly feel like he was stretching Indiana's defense all that much. But he still found a way to put up his stats, to get to the free throw line consistently, to put up big points, and he did that mainly just by turning into a driver, right? They had nobody on the Pacers that could really stay in front of Karl-Anthony Towns that had the size and the quickness to defend him on the perimeter. And albeit those drives were like disgusting to watch, like really horrible on the eyes to watch Karl-Anthony Towns like drive with his knee and scream and flail and flop about to try to get there. But the reality is he's strong as shit. Like that is a truck once he gets moving, and nobody on the Pacers really ever wanted to just like get in front of the guy and take a charge. And so if they're not going to stop you, especially in a playoff setting, like more power to you for repeatedly delivering that contact by repeatedly taking those beatings just to put up some points and find a way to impact the game when the outside shot isn't falling. Also, like there were a couple years ago where Cat had some injury issues. He was obviously able to stay healthy during this regular season, during this playoff run, which was really demanding. And that's not staying healthy for anybody. That's staying healthy for a coach in Tom Thibodeau who decided to play Karl-Anthony Towns basically 40 minutes a game all year long. So the fact that he was able to stay healthy is kind of a surprise and definitely a positive for Team Cat here. And he always cleaned the glass. I think he averaged like 13 rebounds a game against the Pacers as well. And frankly, any concern that you have with Karl-Anthony Towns as like a defensive anchor, right? Like that's where the flaws are. Like, is it possible to win this with this guy with all the defensive concerns you have for Cat? And you combine that with the fact that your best player is a dude that's basically my size. So he's obviously not an asset on the defensive end of the court. So how do we figure that out? But the positive thing for the Knicks is like they somehow during this Boston series unlocked this Mitchell Robinson at the five lineup that gave them a very similar look to what the Timberwolves had last year with Rudy at the five and Cat at the four. Suddenly they have this option that, you know, and I don't want to act like this totally came out of nowhere, right? I'm sure if there's any Knicks fans listening to this, they're probably like screaming at me like, we knew Mitchell Robinson was good. We knew it. We saw it in the regular season. Yeah, whatever, man. He missed 90% of the regular season, 75% of the regular season, whatever it was. I didn't think there was any chance that that guy was going to end up being healthy when they needed him the most and also impactful in a playoff setting when they needed him the most, all right? So it was a surprise, like you can call it a win, whatever. But the reality is, like, Mitchell Robinson was awesome. It's obviously why Tibbs made the decision to start him at the five and bring Josh Hart off the bench. But now that you have that guy that you can turn to, now, is Mitchell Robinson and Cat going to stay healthy for another regular season and postseason run? Who knows? But at some point, you need to take that risk. But I just wanted to point out that any concern you have with Cat, you feel a little bit better having Mitchell Robinson as that option to turn to as well. And then if you want to move on from Bridges because you're not sure how you can pay him after next season, like, I do get it. Like, I still don't fully understand or really understand at all anything to do with this new CBA and how it's going to impact these teams moving forward. But the lack of offensive production for Mikal Bridges, especially with what you paid for him, I get how that's really frustrating on the outside looking in. And he might not be worth that number that he's making in his contract after he deserves an extension next year. I get all that, but he still brings a ton of value as a defender. He still brings a ton of value as probably the best iron man in the NBA with the workload that he's able to sustain. And he's just an overall smart team player that likes being there, that's used to playing with Brunson. And I think overall the lack of offense that we see from Bridges has a lot more to do with the offense that he's in rather than just his overall talent. Because we did see him be a first option for a short period of time in the Nets. We saw him create a little bit more even in Phoenix than what he's asked to do for the New York Knicks. And I think that's just a product of the Tibbs offense and playing alongside a really ball dominant guy in Brunson and Towns, right? I mean, Towns, you know, I like him as an offensive player, obviously, but I think he averaged like less than one or two assists throughout that playoff run. Like, he's not much of a playmaker right about now. So it's just hard for Bridges. So I wouldn't move on from him either. Once you get to the Tibbs piece, I think that's where I'm willing to hear you out a little bit on the decision to maybe make a coaching switch or something like that, because I do get some of the frustration with Tibbs, but overall, was this not the most successful Knicks season that they've had in like decades, right? And every time we talk about coaching in the NBA, because it's so tough, and there's like 2% maybe of all NBA fans that can genuinely watch an NBA game and understand even some of the coaching adjustments that are being made and the strategy that's involved in that, and I'm not in that 2%, so even I don't like to speak on coaching all that much. But I know that the way that casuals and the general NBA population evaluate coaching is who did the most with the least and who exceeded expectations the most. And I don't think anybody in their right mind would have picked the New York Knicks to make it all the way to the conference finals, and more specifically, just beat the Boston Celtics. Like, that feat alone should make any coach bulletproof heading into the next offseason. I just need to say that. Now, if we want to get more specific with it, you know, the huge bugaboo with Tibbs his entire career is just the load that he puts on his starters, right? The fact that he plays these guys, the same five guys, 40-plus minutes a night for 80 games, like, that is really hard to wrap your mind around. And especially when you find yourself in this situation in the playoffs where suddenly you need to reach deeper in the bench. Maybe the other team you're playing or the matchup itself demands a different look, some different options out there, or guys just can't play as hard as they need to for the full 40 minutes like they did in, you know, January or whatever. And Tibbs found himself in that situation, right? Suddenly he needs to reach in the bench and, you know, call on Landry Shamet. He needs to call on DeLon Wright. But the positive thing for him is that he actually got great minutes out of those guys. Like, they played lineups without Cat or Brunson for large stretches in that series against Indiana. Now, they didn't win the series, but those lineups didn't completely crater the team's production at the same time. So you got to give him a shred of credit for being able to make the adjustments that Knicks fans have been clamoring for when it mattered the most. The problem is that, like, hey, maybe if you had done that in the regular season, maybe the team's healthier. Maybe you could have discovered those lineups a little bit earlier. Maybe you could just lighten the load on guys like Brunson and Cat if you're able to depend on those role players a little bit. I don't know. But if you're going glass half full, at least Tibbs was able to figure out those adjustments, and maybe ownership can, you know, impose some sort of, like, hey, you need to play your starters less in the regular season heading into next year. So overall, my recommendation to the Knicks, like I said at the top of this, is just to run it back, because I don't know. Sure, can you get a guy that opens up the offense a little bit more than what Tibbs does right now, that is a little bit less predictable? And, you know, maybe you can find somebody out there that does, you know, lighten the load on the starters and finds more, you know, bench options to go to. Like, I get all that, but the grass isn't always greener. I feel like the Knicks are also a hard team to coach. It's hard for any basketball mind to work around the flaws of having, you know, your best player be really small and your second best player being a liability on defense as well. Like, it's not going to be an easy team to coach. And what we do know is that Tibbs has a ton of experience. He just helped his team exceed expectations this year. And overall, the East is wide open, right? Boston is hurt. Cleveland is embarrassed in the playoffs yet again. Milwaukee is completely cooked. And you just gave the Pacers a really good fight that easily could have been a 7-game series. It probably should have been, and easily could have gone your way. Like, just like the Timberwolves, the Knicks, while they're not in that top tier of contenders at the start of next season, unless something crazy happens in the offseason, they can still easily make the finals, especially next year with Boston injured. And then if you're in that situation, are they going to be in the same class of OKC or whoever comes out of the West next year? Probably not. But still, if you can know you have a good chance of making the NBA finals, and then you're basically a high ankle sprain away from anything being able to happen, right? God forbid a player on the other team gets hurt. Suddenly the Knicks can, you know, luck into a 2019 Raptors championship, and the fan base would definitely take that. So if I'm the Knicks, I'm definitely running it back as well. Let's keep it moving and talk about the Indiana Pacers, their road to the finals, and how they got here. Just to quickly recap, they easily beat the Bucks in round one, got a little bit of injury luck there with the terrible injury that Dame suffered tearing his Achilles, but I think with what we know now about the Pacers, they definitely would have beaten the Bucks either way. Then they go out and embarrass the Cavs, which I'm still kind of processing. I understand that Cleveland had Evan Mobley hurt, Darius Garland was hurt, DeAndre Hunter was hurt, and all those guys missed at least one game in the series, but they still played in most of the games, and the fact that you ended up getting embarrassed in five games when you had home court and you were the best team for most of the regular season, it's just really tough for the Cavs. And then, of course, you have the Pacers' strong win over the Knicks in six games over the past week or so. And this isn't a fluke right now. This is, just like the Timberwolves, the second consecutive conference finals for the Indiana Pacers. Last year, just to remind you guys, they got even more injury luck. No Giannis at all and Dame for only a couple games in round one last year. Then they have a long 7-game series against the Knicks in which Brunson and a few other guys got banged up. But I think Indiana probably would have pulled that out either way. Then they get swept by the Celtics last year, but I think all four of those games were pretty close and competitive. So suddenly you're looking at the Pacers being very opportunistic with how open the East is. They find themselves in the NBA Finals for the first time in over 25 years. And it just kind of posed the question that actually Bill Simmons brought up on his podcast, asking if the Pacers have the best situation in the Eastern Conference. I'm probably doing this like a week or two early because I don't really want to say too much before the NBA Finals, but spoiler alert, I don't think that the Pacers are going to be able to figure out the Thunder in this series, so I'll just come out and say it. I still am not quite there on the Pacers yet, which shouldn't be a surprise. I've been a hater of this team. I've been wrong about them every step of the way. Last year, I had them losing in round one. This year, I had them losing in round one, and overall, this playoffs has just been very humbling about how little I know about this game. I think I had a good couple years starting this podcast thing, and then I fall flat on my face for the playoffs this year. But that shit happens. I promise I'm not trying to be biased against Indiana right here. I just think that there are two other teams in the conference that still have overall a better situation. Maybe not for next year, but just in totality with the assets that they have. I would still take the Cleveland Cavaliers, and I would still take the Boston Celtics over the Pacers. I think it's close. I think the Pacers are easily in that top tier with those other two teams. But after Tyrese Halliburton, you have Pascal Siakam. After that, you're still depending on a group of role players that I think has been awesome in the postseason and a really great coaching staff that enables them. But I'm not quite there yet. When you look at the Boston Celtics and you see Jason Tatum, who we know is a top five player when healthy, we hope he can return to that form. We also see Jaylen Brown, who we know can be a top 25 player when healthy as well. And then you also just have, like, you know, Derek White, one of the best contracts in the NBA. You have some other assets in a crafty front office that has been able to make ends meet. And I think we'll be able to pull a rabbit out of their hat to maintain a competitive status, maybe even next year, as well as the following year after that. And then you just look at Cleveland. It's the talent there too, right? You have a guy in Mobley that continues to ascend. You have Donovan Mitchell, who is an incredible end of game player and scorer. Garland, even if they decide to move on from him or move on from Jared Allen, I think, you know, 29 other teams would have interest in Darius Garland and Jared Allen. So even if they make a trade to shake things up for Cleveland, I think they could come out a really good team next year as well. So I'm not quite ready to anoint the Pacers just yet. But let's just kind of dive into some of the pros and cons against the Oklahoma City Thunder, because this is the NBA Finals matchup, whether we like it or not. And frankly, as I was watching that series against the Knicks, I feel like Indiana definitely has a better chance than the Knicks against the Thunder. I wouldn't say it's a good chance, but it's definitely a better chance than the Knicks or maybe even any other team in the East. Who knows? But I just feel like the superpower of the Indiana Pacers is their pace that they play at, like we just talked about. And it's also their amount of ball handlers that they have. And because of that, the lack of turnovers that they have team-wide, right? They play a really fast-paced style. There's a lot of ball movement. Usually that would lead to more turnovers, which maybe we might see come to fruition against a really incredible defensive team in the Oklahoma City Thunder in the finals. But overall, they just don't turn the ball over and they play with a ton of pace. And I feel like that distinct, unique style that the Pacers have is unlike anything that the Thunder have faced, right? At least it's something different. I would take different over just knowing the Knicks, if they were to trot out there against the Thunder, they're just going to be outclassed. They have a better end of game guy. They have a better team defense. They have way more options and youth and athleticism to throw out the Knicks. They would just be overwhelmed. But the other superpower about the Pacers is, like, I think they're a pretty young team overall. At least they play like it. And they're also a deep team. So those are two pros for the Thunder and really every other matchup, their youth and their depth. The Pacers can at least hang in that department because they do have a nine-man rotation that they can mostly depend on. The front court depth is where things get a little hairy. You're asking a lot of Obi Toppin, and I doubt that Thomas Bryant or Tony Bradley are going to be playable in this series against the Thunder, but at least they have the guard depth and some wing depth to throw at the Thunder, so that's going to be pretty interesting to see how that plays out. And the final pro for the Indiana Pacers in this matchup is just that Rick Carlisle is an incredible coach, and this could be an advantage when you look at Mark Daigneault. I think he's an incredible coach in his own right. Did he push all of the right buttons against Denver? I don't know. It seemed like they choked away at least one or two of those games that probably should have gone OKC's way, and that series probably shouldn't have gotten to seven games. But it just could be worth noting that on paper, me not knowing much about anything, I would still take Rick Carlisle as a coaching advantage over the Thunder in this one, which probably wouldn't have been the case if the Knicks had made it to that point. But you keep all that in mind, you know, OKC, they have the best player. OKC, they have the best team and the most talent. They also have the better defense. And if I'm the Thunder and I'm sitting there like, okay, like the Pacers, their superpower is playing fast and they want to play this loose and, you know, chaotic style of basketball. If I'm the Thunder, I'm just like, all right, bet, right? Like, if you want to play fast and you want to play loose and you want to rely on your athleticism and your depth, like, we can do that too. And we can just do that at a higher level. So ultimately, I think the Pacers are probably going to get cooked in this series, but it is just worth noting that I think they do have an edge over what we would see from the Knicks. Moving over to the road for the Thunder, this one's a little bit less dramatic. They obviously destroy Memphis in round one. That series in which they survive in game seven against Denver, the more we move past that series, the more I'm just like, man, maybe I was onto something with Denver. Like, that series looks even more impressive in hindsight with what we just saw the Thunder do to the Timberwolves. The fact that even defensively, like the Nuggets, like they just do not have the horses that Minnesota has on defense. And the zone that they threw at the Thunder and the way that they made them work for their points, despite how outmatched they were on defense, like, you just got to give the Nuggets even more credit retroactively, looking at how good this Thunder team is. And then, of course, they destroy Minnesota in round three, like we just talked about. Shea, just worth noting, he has a chance to get MVP, conference finals MVP. There wasn't much of a story there because he ended up getting it. And finals MVP in the same season, which would be a really incredible run for a deserving player. And frankly, this is easily the best situation in basketball, right? We talked about, is that, do the Pacers have the best situation in the Eastern Conference? Well, it's not even worth debating because the Thunder have the best situation in basketball overall. Like, maybe if you want to get really bullish on the upside of Wemby, which I am, and the overall outlook for the Spurs, you could put them in that camp. But now that the Celtics have been eliminated and they have this awful Tatum injury, there's not even anybody else in the conversation in my mind. I think the Thunder easily have the best situation. And with that in mind, like, you may look at this team being like they're the youngest in the NBA. They have all this talent. All their guys are under contract. We have all these assets. But you still have to keep in mind, the best player in the world is still in the Western Conference, and he just took you 7 games in a throwaway transition year, right? I'm obviously talking about Jokic and Denver, like we just talked about. They fired their coach with 3 games left in the season. Like, that is a move you make if you felt like your chances with Mike Malone and the current coaching staff and the current general manager were completely fucked. Like, you only do that if you know, hey, we do not have a chance as is, and I will take the unknown over what we've been seeing over the past couple months. And I thought that was a horrible move in the moment because I still believed in Denver, and I was, like, just completely distraught that they decided to fire their coach. I got to give them credit now with the hindsight that we saw. That looked like the right move. David Adelman did a great job with the Nuggets in the playoffs. But you have to keep that in mind. The Nuggets are very much a threat, even in a throwaway year. They were within 1 game of ending your season. You also have Luka and LeBron, you know, a throwaway year in their own right, right? Like, the Lakers trade for Luka. They don't have the right supporting cast around them. They have no bigs whatsoever. And they're still a really competitive team in the West. Of course, Wemby, like we talked about, he's coming along. The new CBA makes it next to impossible to pay everyone over a long period of time. And most importantly, the stars for the Thunder have aligned this year, right? You survived that series against Denver. You easily dispose of Minnesota. And who's waiting for you out of the Eastern Conference? Another team that's young and pretty inexperienced, right? I say another because I think that the Thunder, despite how good they are, they haven't had a ton of playoff lumps, just like the Pacers haven't had all that many either. And you're playing against the 4 seed in the weaker conference. I say all that to say, you have to win this finals if you are the Thunder. You have to. Like, I know that they're in a great situation. I know they have a window way longer than what I could fathom as a Celtics fan last year. Like, I was all in last year. I felt like the Celtics, once Denver got eliminated, I'm like, you have to win this shit. You have to win this shit because you're not going to get a better situation. And we didn't. We did not have a better situation than what we did last year, right? And OKC has a totally different window, and I get that, but you have to win this one. It will be so embarrassing if you go out with this historically great team, this historically great defense, and you lose to the Indiana Pacers. Because suddenly, all those assets that you have, all those picks you have in future years, it almost becomes a detriment. Because other teams know that you can't possibly make all of those selections. You do not have the roster space to just make even all of the first round picks that you have over the next 5 or 6 years. And that becomes a detriment because teams are now basically charging you 75 cents on the dollar for those picks because the other GMs know that Presti has to get rid of them. He's a very smart guy. I'm sure he'll figure that out, how to maximize the value of those picks. But they start burning a hole in your pocket if you know that this Thunder team, it would take something catastrophic to happen for them to lose to the Pacers right now. But if it does, like, how do you not make a move? How do you not, you know, take a look at Giannis? How do you not take a look at Kevin Durant? How do you not explore all those crazy trade potentials? And they've obviously stayed away from that. And the 2 moves that they made this past offseason were clearly genius in getting Alex Caruso for Josh Giddey and being able to sign Isaiah Hartenstein. Like, those were all the moves that the Thunder needed in all likelihood. But I'm just saying, despite how well they are set up for future years, you have to win this series against the Indiana Pacers. And if they don't, it'll be an absolute disaster. So all that being said, my finals prediction is going to be the Thunder in 5 games. I'll show a little bit of respect to the Pacers. I think that they are able to steal one of those games. Maybe Haliburton can recreate the magic of what he had in, what was that, game 4, where he had that 30-point triple-double. Maybe there's one Haliburton game which the Pacers are able to win. Maybe it's another Nembhard, Nesmith game where one of those role players just goes off for 30. We will see. But I think they steal one game. But the problem is that the Thunder have an advantage no matter how the games go. No matter how the games are officiated, the Thunder have an advantage, right? You want to play it, you know, really old-school, physical basketball where guys are getting away with a lot of contact. that plays right into the Thunder's hand, because suddenly you have Lu Dort and Alex Caruso out there just harassing people, just patting them down every single time before they even cross half court. Like, it's going to be a bloodbath, and that favors the Thunder. And on the flip side of things, if you want to call it really close and really tight, there's a quick whistle with everything. Next thing you know, Shai is going to be shooting 20 free throws in that game, and that's not an exaggeration, right? He really will get to the line 15, 20 times if you call that quick whistle. And on the other side of the ball, like, the Pacers just don't really have anybody to get to the line on command, like what the Thunder are able to do with Shai. So it's going to be really hard for the Pacers in this one. Like, and I know we just had a Halliburton kind of coming out party in that series against the Knicks, and he was awesome for the majority of that series. And even before that, in the rounds against the Cavs and Bucks and all that stuff, he's had moments in every single round. He deserves, you know, the flowers and the attention that he's getting right now. He is the best player on a team that is in the finals, so you got to give him some credit. But man, shit is not that sweet against the Thunder, right? If you thought, you know, life was tough and it was hard playoff buckets against the Knicks and the Cavs, get ready to learn Lu Dort, buddy. It's going to be tough for Tyrese Halliburton. It's going to be really hard for him to avoid the trap that he fell into in game five, where he just doesn't even shoot, right? Where he took seven shots in that game five against the Knicks. Like, he's going to have to be uber aggressive and take any sliver that he's able to get, especially from beyond the arc, because the Thunder are going to know he's going to want to get to that step back jumper. And he has the most comfort in his outside shooting above any part of his offensive game besides just pushing it up the floor. So I just feel like the Thunder are really well equipped, whether it's Lu Dort, whether it's Alex Caruso. It really doesn't matter whether it's Case and Wallace. They have 3 to 5 guys that are going to be fantastic in the situation to guard Tyrese Halliburton, maybe 3 to 5 guys that are better than any defensive matchup that he's faced so far. So I just feel like it's probably not going to be a very competitive series. So I'm going with Thunder in 5. So that is going to do it for this podcast episode. Hopefully you guys enjoyed. I did just want to, before I let you guys go, just touch upon the fact that, like, just brace yourselves as NBA fans. Hopefully you guys get annoyed with this topic as much as I do. The NBA ratings discourse, it's coming. It's going to happen. We have a Thunder Pacers NBA Finals, 2 small markets. You know, one team that a lot of people expected to be there in the Thunder, and then another team that nobody saw coming. Not necessarily the biggest clash of stars or storylines, and, you know, there might be a lack of excitement after a major market and a major fan base of the Knicks gets eliminated when they had a real chance against the Pacers. I get all that. Just avoid it, because it's going to happen. I'm sure the numbers will be down. I can't even say that, because I don't think that many people were fired up for Celtics-Mavs, but just don't let it bother you, right? Because I do think we have 2 deserving teams. The Pacers made the most out of what was a crapshoot in the East this year. As much as I'm completely disgusted that my Celtics are not playing in the finals and the fact that they couldn't even make it to the conference finals, the Pacers deserve to be here, and it's not going to stop me from watching and enjoying the NBA Finals. The Thunder, this could be the first part of a crazy Thunder documentary someday. If you're catching my drift, they are really well equipped to dominate the next decade in the NBA, but they have to get one first. The first one's always going to be the toughest. Sam Presti, he's been considered the best general manager in the NBA for like 2 decades now. That guy's never won a title. This is a huge opportunity for him. So I'm still really going to enjoy this finals. We're still getting 2 teams that play a unique style, with the Thunder's like just absolutely strangling defense, the Pacers, you know, with how quickly that they play. It's 2 fun teams, and I think we are going to get at least 1 or 2 competitive games in this series, so just be sure to tune in for all of them, because there's still going to be some fun moments in what overall probably won't be the most competitive NBA Finals series. And just brace yourself for the ratings discourse. It's all make-believe numbers. It doesn't represent the league health overall. Just some years are going to be more enticing matchups than others. I don't think this is a particularly exciting matchup, but it doesn't mean that you guys shouldn't watch the finals and enjoy the product, because we are going to get a couple good games in that mix. So without further ado, I'll let you guys go. I should be back next week. Hopefully I'll get my guy Ian on. It's been a while since I caught up with him. You guys might remember him. He is a massive Thunder fan. Also has done his own sports journalism through the years. So we'll make him maybe dust off the mic and talk Thunder with us. We'll see. Hopefully the schedule of my recordings and the schedule for these games aligns. I'm going to be going to Nashville later this week, so we won't have the most time to record, but maybe I can get you guys a podcast like after game 2, after game 3, something like that. But definitely expect to hear from me at least 1 more time before the end of the NBA Finals. So without further ado, be sure to follow @WordsWithWallace on everything that includes Spotify, Apple Music, wherever you get your podcasts. And I will talk to you guys next week. Peace.